Thank you. Be seated. Court is now ready to hear oral arguments and petition in Hull State Bank versus Jones.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Johnson will present arguments to the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case involves an issue of conversion and the damages arising from the conversion of a truck and trailer by Hull State Bank. Hull is a small farming and ranching community in East Texas with about 1,000 people. And as most of the justices know, that area had a tremendous downturn in their economy. As a result of that, many banks in the area were placed under supervision. That happened to Hull State Bank in the 86-87 era. And during that period, Mr. Jones had been farming and doing his banking with Hull State Bank, and he had lost an amount of over $225,000 over a seven-year period. The bank was under supervision. The bank was prohibited from extending any further credit to Mr. Jones. It was told that they had to either have Mr. Jones move his line of business, his notes, or there'd have to be some liquidation of his assets. Mr. Jones had lost money continually. He owed the bank over $180,000 as of November of 1987. And at that point in time, he approached the bank. He had moved to Dilley, Texas to be in a truck farming business. He approached the bank and offered to sell his home and some land, which the bank declined to take because that would have been illegal. It was his homestead. As an alternative, he offered to sell his farm equipment. So at that point in time, in November of 87, the bank agreed with Mr. Jones to allow him to have his farm equipment liquidated, sold, and they would forgive him of about $100,000 in debt, which he owed on the farm debt. It was $98,000 and some change. So at that point in time, the fair market value of the farm equipment was about $14,000. And that is important because one of the things that the court will review is Tannenbaum, the Tannenbaum decision, and the Adcock decision. This is not a case where the bank unilaterally and without the agreement of Mr. Jones sold the equipment. As a matter of fact, Mr. Jones in his pleadings judicially admitted that he had agreed that the bank would sell his farm equipment. The jury found unanimously that in November of 1987, the bank and Mr. Jones had agreed to sell his farm equipment and apply it to the debt. In reliance on that agreement, the bank, in fact, did sell the equipment and applied it to the debt. The complaint of Jones was, well, that he wasn't given notice of the sale. It's our position under the Uniform Commercial Code that under 9504, if there's an agreement between the parties to sell the collateral and apply it to the note, there is no default that then requires a notice. It's our position that when you have an agreed sale, as we had in this case, as judicially admitted by the defendant, and as found by the jury, that there is no need to give them notice of the sale because they've already agreed to it. In this situation, at that point in time, Mr. Jones owed the bank about $146,000 as of the time that the notes went into default. And I think that is default is a key issue because it's our position that there could be no award of mental anguish damages. There could be no conversion if Mr. Jones was in default on the notes or in default of the November 87 agreement when the bank took possession of the truck and trailer. And that's what the judgment was entered on. The court entered a judgment on the conversion claim of Mr. Jones, saying that the bank converted the truck and trailer when they took when they repossessed the truck and trailer in May of 1988. It's significant to know
that Mr. Jones, on April the 26th, 1988, well prior to May of 1988, unequivocally, and it was undisputed in trial, that Mr. Jones told the bank that he would not pay on any of his notes and that he wanted, that he was going to sue the bank if they had released the title for the truck and trailer.
Is that evidence that the bank felt insecure?
I believe it is, Your Honor. That was the testimony of Mr. Zabronic, the bank's attorney, who sent the man letters that were denied or ignored by Mr. Jones.
The focus has been on the two big notes and foreclosure and whether they were, notice was given and whether the debt was discharged. But why isn't that statement, if it was made, enough evidence to put the bank, to give the bank reason to foreclose on the other three notes?
We believe it was, Your Honor, because Mr. Jones unequivocally told the bank people testified that two bank officers said that Mr. Jones told them he wasn't going to pay on any of the notes, including the three notes that the trial court literally found were not at default. The jury found repudiation. This court, in, I think in the Holly case, ruled recently that when there's a repudiation of a contract, that is a breach of the contract, it suspends performance by the other party. It's our position that when the jury found that, that Jones failed to comply with the November of 1987 agreement, which included, the November of 87 agreement included the requirement that the truck and trailer should be renewed with the reduction of principal interest and paid current. Now, it's also the bank's position that that on before May 29th, 1988, that was the day that the truck and trailer were repossessed, they in good faith believed the prospect of payment or performance was impaired. So it's our position that there can be no conversion. There's long-standing law in Texas that if there's a default, there can be no conversion from the bank, and it's undisputed that they had notes, they had security agreements on this, the truck and trailer. Those were entered into evidence without any objection, and I think this court has ruled in the Stanley Boot case in 1992, that once the notes are admitted into evidence with no objection, the bank is entitled to collect on the notes. It was also undisputed that Mr. Jones refused to pay the truck and trailer note and said he wasn't going to make any payments prior to the repossession. It's also our position that the trial court was wrong. The jury unanimously found that there was $146,000 owed to the bank. Instead of using, even if the court wanted to, under Tannenbaum, say that the large form note and the FMHA note were discharged, there were still three other notes. Even if the court was right, that by failure to give notice on the sale of the form equipment, that could only have discharged the large form note and the FMHA note. The trial court disregarded the jury's findings that the other three notes were in default. Without a motion, and without any, there was no motion for entry of judgment, notwithstanding the verdict. There was no motion filed by the plaintiff to disregard any jury findings. But the court on its own motion disregarded questions 10, 19, and 20 in order to come up with a net recovery to Mr. Jones. It's also our position on the mental anguish damages that there was no finding of malice. The jury did find a conversion. However, the conversion issue should have been conditionally submitted. And in that, it should have been, the question should have been, was Mr. Jones in default on these three notes? If he was, the bank could not have converted. However, just a conversion issue was submitted without any predicate on a default.
On the mental anguish damages, you're not arguing that there's no evidence, insufficient evidence to support the award. That's not in your brief.
That's correct.
I'm not sure that the level of his frustration and loss of sleep and that sort of thing meets the level that is necessary in order to be awarded.
But you haven't argued it in the brief.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what you have argued is that you can't get it in a case like this.
Well, there was no malice finding by the jury. It's our contention that with respect to the only theory on which the judgment was entered, conversion, that there could not be any conversion as a matter of law because the three notes were in default.
Did you raise the complaint that you can't get it in a case like this or without a malice finding in the trial court?
We did, Your Honor.
Where?
We made that objection. In the charge conference, at on the statement of facts, pages 2482 through 2484, and 2489 through 2491, and also I would add that counsel for the Joneses stipulated during the presentation of the evidence that the mental anguish proof is being put on only on the issue of punitive damages. It's our position that they stipulated to that and they're bound by it.
Did you raise it in any post-trial motions?
We did, Your Honor, both in Beaumont and all the way up. I believe my time is out.
Any other questions? 5 more minutes. You don't have to be quiet until the red light goes on, but okay. If you're out of time, you don't have to keep talking.
I'll be glad to answer any more questions. I think that I reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Real quickly, to follow up, you said you raised the issue on mental anguish damages. You didn't post-trial motions at the trial court?
We did. We filed a motion with the court to disregard that finding. We've pointed that out in our brief, that we timely objected to the mental anguish being submitted at the charge conference. There was no pleading on it. It should not have been submitted as actual damages, and we didn't. We also objected that it was not recoverable unless there was a finding of malice as a predicate.
When did you first raise that?
I'm sorry?
When did you first raise that?
I believe we even raised that before we went to trial, Your Honor. I know that we objected during the trial to the evidence on that, and that's why the stipulation came about. Mr. Moorfield stipulated they were only putting that on for the purposes of punitive damages, and then we objected at the charge conference.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Joe Alfred Eisen will present argument from the petitioner.
Your Honor, this was a case with many issues. It involved deceptive trade practice, good faith, and fair dealing. It had mental anguish as part of conversion. We submitted a wrongful coercion claim that we obtained a jury verdict on.
Which how many issues were there on this case?
Oh, gosh. Over 40, Your Honor. 47. I think the Court of Appeals tracked the issues in the middle of its opinion. They analyzed how the issues were decided. I'll have that answer for you in just a second.
That's all right.
49. Got it quick. Now, the 49 issues, what do you do? Did the trial court disregard anything here? I'm going to be arguing beyond what I think was granted before this court. The assignment of error here, that error that Rick was granted on, is only number 3. Number 3, as it's stated, does say, as Judge Hecht has pointed out, that you can't get mental anguish in a case like this. He didn't raise the sufficiency, that the Court of Appeals didn't apply the right sufficiency rules, which is all you rule on here. You don't re-examine the facts except to make sure that the Court of Appeals examined them in the proper legal manner.
You and agree that issue was raised in the trial court?
Was it raised in the trial court?
Yes, sir.
Probably so, at some point, in all of the arguments. We had about 200 or 300 pages of arguments over how the charge would be submitted and also the motions for new trial and all the rest of the thing. What I'm trying to say is we get to the Court of Appeals. The other side's supposed to assign proper error to this court by the writ of error. And you, as I understand it, grant writ of error restricted to specific points?
Well, we have the whole case before us.
Well, you granted on writ of error number 3. I will respond then. In light of that comment, I'll respond to the argument that jury issues were totally disregarded by the trial court. That's not true.
Let me ask you.
The jury issues were reconciled. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you first. The Court of Appeals states in its opinion on April 26, 1988, Jones told the bank that he would not make any future payments on the notes and demanded release on all indebtedness.
Yes.
That's true, I take it.
I believe that is true.
Why didn't that give the bank, as a matter of law, reason to feel insecure about the repayment of the three vehicle notes?
I came to argumental anguish, and I would like Mr. Moorfield to be able
right.
to respond to that, but I will say this, that the jury found there was excessive demands made. I'll let Mr. Moorfield explain that, but there are two sets of notes for security. There are the notes for the farm equipment that the man actually did rice farming with, that there was agreement that that debt would be forgiven in November of 1987. Let's see here, I think it was November 1987. There's a letter agreement to that effect. Then there is the foreclosure where the bank demands all of the money that it was owed before it agreed to forgive rice farming indebtedness. And they make those demands before the May 1988 date that they pick up the equipment. The jury found there were excessive demands made. They made more demand than what they were entitled to make. The jury also found that there was a fear and good faith on the part of Hull State Bank about their security. But we didn't have a finding as to when there was a fear about the security. That could have been before November of 87 when they made the agreement to forgive the farm indebtedness, and it could have been after, as you're pointing to.
Well, then I'm going to ask you, why wasn't it on April 26th when the Mr. Jones made the statement that the Court of Appeals said he made?
The answer to that is the jury was asked on or before May of 1988, were they in fear of their security? And we obtained a jury verdict to the fact that seemingly inconsistent, that there was excessive demands made, and the only way you can reconcile those is to hold what the courts did. You have to save each part of the jury verdict that you can, that's the rules, that they were not in conflict and that any fear they had, therefore, I interpreted, was before that November 87 agreement, or at least in such a situation that the jury issues and answers did not come to.
Well, looks like if the debtor writes the bank and says, I'm not going to pay you anymore, that as a matter of law, that means that the bank ought to feel sort of insecure about its collection.
There was no argument that as a matter, that I know of, as a matter of law that excused the submission of the jury issue on that. I'm dealing with the jury issue. I'll take any more questions you have on that background, but I came basically to concentrate on mental anguish because I thought this was an examination of mental anguish. We obtained a knowing finding on deceptive trade practices. And I think it's the Beeston case, which was reversed by this court from the Austin Court of Appeals, they held in the insurance code, I believe, that you had to have a knowing finding. This is not a case where we don't have a knowing finding of conduct to support mental anguish. So, the next question then is, do we have a quantum of evidence to support mental anguish? Are we required to produce physical manifestation evidence? Or is there required to be some physical proof of mental anguish? The Court of Appeals tracked the proof of mental anguish, the award, what it was based on. The gentleman's hair turned gray. And I also point out that they had a business. They had another business besides the rice farming business. It was a business with these pickup trucks that he had, the truck and the trailers Mr. Johnson has referred to. Essentially, they interfered with his business and put him out of business. The Court of Appeals of Tyler just recently, after having the benefit, I'm sorry, the Court of Appeals of Tyler, after having the benefit of your opinion, I guess, in your latest case, which was Parker on mental anguish, I believe. This Tyler case came out July 7, 1995. they point out to a distinction of mental anguish about the physical proof requirement being dispensed with when there's proof of an intentional tort that interferes with someone's business. And that is the Adeline Likes case, L-I-K-E-S, versus the City of Tyler, Appalachia. I gave you the date on it. It's number 12-93-00273-CV. No reason that it's not in the reports. Now, as far as mental anguish is concerned in this case, there is both the physical evidence of the man's hair turning gray and the other evidence that we listed from the wife to support that, but also the legal argument that mental anguish can lie in this case without such proof because of that business exception, which the Tyler Court of Appeals refers to and which was recognized in Brown and Root Incorporated versus City of Cities Municipality, 721 Southwest 2nd, 881. That's the Houston Court of Appeals First District case. I'm going to let Mr. Moorfield respond here to your question further about the issue of matter of law, fear of their security, which would excuse the picking up of the equipment as a matter of law.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Mr. Moorfield should have part of my time if it's permissible. Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Mark Moorfield from Liberty, on behalf of the respondent. Justice Heck, in answer, I believe, to your question with regard to Holstate Bank's insecurity and why, as a matter of law, Holstate Bank would not be insecure. In May of 1988 when that statement was made, I think the answer is in two parts. Number one, some couple of months before this repossession, Mr. Jones had purchased an extension of time on each of these notes. He had paid valuable consideration, and this note, none of the notes, the truck nor the trailer note, were a monthly pay type obligation. They were a lump sum obligation due sometime in the future. The notes were actually called prior to their stated maturity for which Jones had paid valuable consideration. But when we get to the jury charge and the answer to the jury questions, and I believe what Mr. Eisen was referring to, is that we had what appeared to be a conflict in the jury answers. And as this court is aware, a trial judge has a duty to reconcile apparently conflicting jury answers, because it's presumed that a jury does not intend to return a verdict of that nature that's clearly in conflict. The issues that were submitted by Holstate Bank inquired as to Jones's performance on all of these notes, the FMHA note, the large farm note, as well as what we've come accustomed to call the truck, and trailer note. And it's in the brief, specifically the issue on insecurity, paraphrasing it, jury question number 20 inquired into whether Holstate Bank on or before May 29, 1988 believed that the prospect of payment or performance was impaired under any of the notes or security agreements. Of course, the jury had before it not just the truck and trailer note that forms the basis of this conversion cause of action, the jury award, but also the FMHA note and the large farm note, which our position is, because the equipment that secured those two notes was sold without regard to the notice requirements of disposition under Section 9.504, they were extinguished at that time. So a default could not be predicated upon non-payment of those notes. The jury could very well have said and considered that, yes, prospect of payment under the FMHA note was impaired, or prospect of payment under the large farm note was impaired at any time during this long history of Jones with Holstate Bank. In stark contrast to that, Jones obtained specific findings from the jury, paraphrasing again, jury questions number 28 and 32, that on or before May 29, 1988, Holstate Bank called the notes on Jones' truck, and trailer and repossessed the items for the purpose of wrongfully coercing Jones into paying the balances due on the notes held by Holstate Bank, and not because such notes were in default. Jury question number 28 likewise finds specifically that the notes were not in default, the specific truck trailer notes on that particular day.
Well, but the jury also found that the bank was in good faith when it believed that its payment was, the security was impaired.
At to what point in time? I think that's my point.
Question number 20 did not specify time. It just said a global question. The bank in good faith, the bank in good faith believed its prospect of payment was impaired.
I know that's my point, Judge, is that the jury could very well have considered Hull State Bank's mental process at a time prior to the repossession, or under the FMHA note, or under the large farm note.
But the two big notes were gone on April 26th.
But they were before the jury, though.
I understand
evidence
that.
Of that.
But the two big notes were gone on April 26th when Mr. Jones told the bank, I'm not going to pay anymore.
Well, that is correct. But that
it looks to me like if you were a bank and your credit and your debtor said, I'm not going to pay anymore, you'd feel a little insecure about your payment, sort of as a matter of law. Unless you thought he was joking.
The notes were
that's not very funny.
He had a
counsel, doesn't that amount to repudiation of the note?
The truck trailer notes?
Yeah.
I don't know, based on the record, which, in this particular statement, which notes this statement referred to. Whether it's the truck trailer notes, whether it's the FMHA note, whether it's the large farm
would
note.
Would it be reasonable to assume that it, for the banker to assume it applied to all the notes, if he said, I'm not going to pay them anymore?
Well, perhaps so, Judge, but I think also it would be the petitioner in this case, his obligation to obtain a specific jury finding to that effect. The bank did not obtain a specific jury finding to that effect. In fact, the trial court, in reconciling the specific with the general, as it's required to do, the specific certainly governs and rules and controls over the general, and we have specific jury findings that under these three particular notes, on the date of repossession, those notes were not in default.
Just to follow up a moment on Judge Hightower's question, it is true, I don't have chronology here, I do, but on April 26, the other two, the two big notes had already been foreclosed on, hadn't they, in your position, as they were discharged?
As a matter of law, yes, the principles of 9504.
So the statement made on April 26 had to refer to the other three notes.
Jones did not know, as a matter of law, that Tannenbaum and 9504 and the unlawful disposition of collateral had that result. And we were not able to instruct the jury to that effect either, nor advise the jury by evidence or argument or otherwise. So when the jury is answering these jury questions, they are naturally considering Jones's performance under all obligations from the beginning of his relationship with Hull State Bank up until the date of that trial. I think the court had a duty to reconcile these findings, and certainly, as my understanding of the law is, on these specific jury findings that the specific does control over the general.
Any other questions? Thank you, Governor.
I'd like to clear up a couple of points, if I may, on the opinion by the Court of Appeals of Beaumont. The Court of Appeals of Beaumont states two places in their opinion that the bank apparently relied upon the default and the large note and the FMHA note as a basis for repossessing of the truck and trailer. That is simply inaccurate because the testimony by everyone, the bank's lawyers each brought, two of the bank officers that testified, said that at the point in time Mr. Jones came in on April 26th and said, I'm not going to pay any of my notes. And that was Jones, it's undisputed testimony that Jones said, I'm not going to pay any of my notes. At that point in time, they became insecure. And that is why on May 20th, Zeke's chronic wrote him a letter and said, Mr. Jones, your default on your notes, what are you going to do about it? Didn't reply, didn't call, didn't go by the bank, didn't do anything. Sent another letter on May 31st, Mr. Jones, you still haven't replied to my letter. Your default from truck and trailer, we're going to go by, we
We have a right to repossess it. If you don't come take care of the notes, we're going to repossess the notes. And this is a man that owed the bank $180,000. Even if you take off the $100,000 that they were forgiving in November, he's still owed $80,000. He's saying, I'm not going to pay the notes, and I'm going to sue you if you don't release all my titles, the truck, and trailer.
What was the basis of his request to release all?
He just said, he had made the agreement in November for the farm equipment to be sold. Pursuant to that agreement, he came in and renewed the notes, which was part of the condition under that. Then, by the time the farm equipment was sold, and it goes down here and he renews some of these notes pursuant to the November of 87 agreement, sometime in there, I think he gets mad about something, I don't know what. And he decides that now, 4 or 5 months later, he's not going to live up to that November of 87 agreement. The testimony was that he changed his mind when he went to see Mr. Moorfield and Mr. Isaac, his lawyers. That's the point in time that his attitude changed when he went to get legal advice about what his position was. The other fallacy of their argument, and it's very important, the jury found that Jones repudiated the November 87 agreement with Hull State Bank. The jury found that Jones failed to comply with the 1987 agreement. The key part of the 87 agreement was Mr. Jones will forgive you $100,000 in debt, will sell the farm equipment, apply that to the note, but you have to pay off the truck and trailer note. When the jury found it was the default of the November 87 agreement, they found that he had repudiated his agreement to pay the truck and trailer note. And that's why there can be no conversion as a matter of law, because it's a default. And the bank under the Uniform Commercial Code has the absolute right under their notes and security agreements and the UCC to go pick up the truck and trailer. That's all I have, unless there are any questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim. That concludes the argument, and the second case, the court will